Thank you, Art.
Good evening. My name is David Lloyd, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am so privileged to be here. What a pleasure for Donna and I to come down today and be with you this evening. The elevators are a tad bit slow as you want to come up and down the elevator shaft. So, but I want to thank Marshall. Marshall, in fact, we met a couple of years ago, and Marshall has called, he has written, he has done everything possible to make me know and to let me know and Donna know what we need to do and when we need to be here. He's been excellent to work with. Marshall, thank you very much. And Darwin, also thank you for your hospitality this weekend. Darwin and Marshall picked us up at the airport today, took us to a great lunch. Wow. And we had a good dinner tonight. To the committee, I want to thank you. I've had a chance to meet some of you. I don't believe I've met everyone, but I really appreciate your efforts. What a beautiful conference this is. It's a pleasure to be here from North Carolina. My sponsor, Keith L., said to please give you a hello. That's who Art was referring to. And my grand sponsor, Tom I., says to please give you a hello. I think some of those folks have been down in your area in the last few months or years. I want to talk to you tonight about a disease I have. You know, I want to tell you that when I went to the treatment center when I was almost 41, I didn't have a disease. I think I caught it there. I'm not sure. It was like a, you know, it was one of those deals. You know, I was walking down the hall. I think the guy in 2 or 3 had a real bad case. I mean, a must have, because by the third day I caught it. I mean, I didn't have it when I got there. The only reason I went there is because my family said I had to. You know, in fact, my wife Donna said, don't come back. It's one of those deals. Those are, you know, no margin of error there. So I said, okay, I won't. But I want to tell you about this disease because, you know, I lived for 39 years, 11 months, and 3 weeks and didn't know I had it. I just thought I was a bad person trying to get good. You know what I'm saying? Have you ever, I thought I just need to try a little harder. You know, just try a little harder. I mean, to do a few things. I need to gain weight when I was younger. I need to lose weight when I got older. You know, I need to wear different clothes. I need to go out. No, I need to go in. You know, something like that. I mean, it was always something. It just never worked out. And I was standing at the, after a month of treatment and 2 months in a halfway house with Clara, this wonderful counselor, and I was kind of packed ready to go home. And she said to me, David, if you go back out and drink again, it's because you don't accept the fact that you have a disease. I said, yes, I do. And you know what? I was lying. I didn't accept it any more than a man in the moon. You know what? She said, you think you're just a bad person trying to get good, and what you got to do is go home and just be good. She said, and if you do that, you'll go back out and drink because you have a disease. And until you accept that, it's not going to get any better. And until you accept it, it means you go to AA meetings. It means you get a sponsor. It means you work the 12 steps. It means you read the big book. It means you read the 12 and 12. It means you do whatever you have to do, even if your butt falls off. And I said, well, I understand. And she said, what would you do if you broke both your legs and they put you in a body cast up to your armpits? I said, well, I'd probably lay in bed. She said, how long? I said, well, until they cut the cast off. She said, how long do you think that would be? I said, 7 weeks, I guess. She said, so you would lay in bed for 7 weeks to let your body heal from 2 broken legs. She said, will you give yourself some time? Will you go home and not get well? Will you be sick a while? It was best advice I ever had. Best advice I ever had. And I told her I would, but I didn't believe it. And I spent with Keith, my sponsor, since I got sober. We have spent my time in sobriety trying to accept the fact that I have a disease. You know, when I don't accept the fact that I have a disease, you know what I am? I am real powerful. I don't need anybody. I don't need meetings. I don't need the first step, for sure. But when I can accept the fact that I have a disease, I'm powerless. And what that means is I'm teachable. I'm willing to listen to you. I'm willing to listen to my sponsor. I'm actually willing to call him. That's a novelty. It was like this, and I want to read this to you in the big book, page 62. This, to me, is the definition of my disease. It's the best I've ever heard. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of all of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity, we stepped on the toes of our fellows seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Hundreds of forms of fear, hundreds of forms of self-seeking, hundreds of forms of self-delusion, hundreds of forms of self-pity. I want to talk about that because those four things, I think, are really my disease. I want to talk about the fear. I don't know about you, but fear kind of starts right here in me. And if I stay with it long enough, it keeps getting bigger. And it goes up in the neck, contention, up into the head, get nauseated, a little diarrhea. Can't think, flunk exams, I know the stuff, just flunked them in school, couldn't get with it. That's what I do if I stay with fear long enough. And it's like this, it's like God called all the 8-year-olds in the world together, and he put them in a stadium. And he said, and I shared this afternoon in a resentment meeting, but he said this, I'm going to teach you about how to grow up and how to go through puberty and how to graduate from high school and how to get a spouse and how to have a family and how to get a responsible job and have a wonderful life. And just as he started, I had to go to the bathroom. And so I went to the bathroom and came back, and God was saying, and now you know all the secrets there are to know about living. And on the way out of the stadium, people would say things like, oh, you know about dating, don't you, David? I said, of course I do. I didn't know. I'd call girls, and I was so frightened. I'd call girls, and I wouldn't speak because I was so frightened. And then I'd hang the phone up, and then I'd say, oh, no, they know who just called them. You know about puberty, don't you, David? Of course I do. I didn't know. I thought I had cancer until my older brother figured out, filled me in on the deal. I had no clue what was going on with my body. No idea. But you know what I had to do? I had to know. It's like this. The first memory I have in my fourth and fifth step work with Keith, the first memory I have is I was, I think, 6 or 7 in a car, the back seat, my brother Larry. He was 13 months, 2 days older than me. He still is. Nothing's changed there. But he was in the back seat with me. And we were driving to an aunt's house. My mother and my dad was driving. And my mother pointed back in the back seat, and she said, now, when we get to Aunt Sue's, don't you ask for one thing, not even a drop of water. Because I don't want Sue to say, Letha and Claudia, my mom and my dad, or welcome back here, but those mean youngins had never better come again here. Now, some places where I speak, I have to tell them what youngins means, but I think y'all all know that. That's a North Carolina term for children. Those mean youngins had never come again. And the next thing I remember, I was sitting on a wooden bench by the back door watching all the adults in the living room. And I don't know if you ever did this, but I sat on my hands. I had them under my thighs. I knew if I touched something, I'd get in trouble. And I don't know if it started that day, but I remember it that day. If anybody came within 10 feet of me, here's what I started doing. They would come close, and I'd start smiling like this. And I start shaking my head like this. And I'm not even Japanese. But I was like, and these words just kind of mumble out of my mouth. I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. How are you? Oh, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. Are you fine? I'm fine. Thank you. I'm fine. Need anything? Oh, no. I'm fine. Thank you. I'm fine. Couldn't ask for anything. Not even a drop of water. I'm fine. I'm doing fine. I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. I call it fine, and I perfected fine into a fine art. And I'd say things like this, how are you doing? Are you okay? And you know what I was really asking? Am I okay with you? I really didn't care about the person. It was if I was okay. If you had a frown on your face, you found it very difficult to leave my presence because it had to be about me. And if you had a frown on your face, I would say, wait, now let me tell you one more thing. And I had to get a smile because if it wasn't, I knew that you were going to be upset with me. And I would say things, somebody would say, can you come over Friday night? And I'd say, oh, no, I can't come over Friday night. I've got something else to do. And I'd go to class in high school, and I'd sit there and think, and this stuff would get real big, and I'd think, oh, she'll never speak to me again. And I had to find her. It's just this constant fear of not being enough. The thing I asked my mom when I got in the car that night when we left Aunt Sue's, I got in the car, I said, Mom, how did I do? Did I do okay? Are they going to want me back? I don't know if you know that feeling, but going through life wondering if they're going to want you back. I'm okay. I mean, am I? And I'm asking all the time, everybody I meet, am I? Hundreds of forms of fear. Hundreds of forms of fear. And it works like this. Hundreds of forms of self-delusion. I heard this in Dallas in 1988 at an AA meeting. This guy named Joe said, alcoholism is a disease characterized by pyramiding thoughts. And I went, whoa, that's pretty good. That's a $5 word. I said, how does that work? And it works just like this. It's not this way. It comes right out of my head. Now, here's what happens to me. I'm fine. How are you? Good morning. I'm fine. 10 o'clock, Tuesday morning, sitting in my office. Good morning. I'm fine. How are you? My boss walks by my door. Hey, Don, how's it going? And he doesn't speak. Hey, Don, good morning. He doesn't speak. And here it goes. It starts right here. First thought, wonder why he didn't speak to me. Second thought, he's probably upset with me. Third thought, I bet it was that report I gave him yesterday. He didn't like that report. Fourth thought, well, he said he wanted to talk to me yesterday. I bet it's because he wants to fire me. And these thoughts just come boom, 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 and they just fill up this pyramid. Boom, 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 boom. Well, he's probably got that meeting at 2 o'clock. I bet he is going to fire me. Well, I can't go to lunch today. If he runs into me, he might fire me at lunch, so I can't go to lunch. 10 o'clock, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. Good morning. 10:01, I'm fired. I haven't left my desk. I haven't left my office. And what I do is I start pyramids off of pyramids. I'll have a pyramid going, he's going to fire me, and then I'll think, well, if he fires me, I've got to go down to Ray Avenue in Fayetteville to the unemployment office and get an unemployment check. And I'll think, well, what if they won't give me one? Here comes another pyramid. 10 o'clock, I find, how are you? 10:01, I'm fired. 10:01 and a half, I can't get an unemployment check. And my family's going to starve. I'm already planning to go by the day-old bread Marita store to buy some day-old bread on the way home. I don't know if y'all know this stuff. Just an ordinary Tuesday day. And you know what the funny part is? If somebody walks in my office while that process is going on and they say, good morning, David, how are you doing? You know what I say? I'm fine, how are you? That's right, yeah, y'all been there. Yeah, you been there. Yeah. It happens to me like this. Get up one morning and I've got a little pimple on this calf right here and I start scratching it. I get in the shower, dry off. Now I'm putting on my socks to go to work and I look down. It's got a little red circle around it. Here it goes. I don't remember there on my leg last night. I think it's a knot under the skin. Must be a tumor. Well, if it's a tumor, they're going to cut my leg off right here. And I'll need to go down and get fitted for a prosthesis. I'm sitting on my bed trying to go to work, worried about getting a prosthesis. You know what I'm talking about? I hope I'm not the only one in this room. I was comparing today. I think Marshall and I were talking at lunch about going into the hospital and doing all these tests, you know, and they finally come back and say, there's nothing wrong with you. You're a very healthy person. But boy, it was here. I was sick. Woo! I was going to die. I thought I did it only with bad things. About 6 years ago, I was in the shower one morning, and I was humming a country and western tune. Now, I don't know why I was doing that, because my life was going along pretty well at that time. But I was humming this country western tune. And the next thing I remember, I get out of that shower, and I'm over at the mirror, and I'm thinking, of course. And the next thought I had was, where am I going to get a tour bus? A tour bus. So some of you may have been there, too. Some real quick responses on that one. And I went back and I said, well, I don't need a tour bus. And I'm thinking, why? And I went back and I went to the shower and I was humming this country west tune. And first thought was, that sounds pretty good. If I practice, I bet I could sing country and western music. And if I got a group together around here in Fayetteville, play a few gigs, we could go out to Nashville. And then we could get a bigger group out there and we could sign a contract and go on tour and I'll need a tour bus. Of course, it all makes sense. Do you know what I'm saying? It all makes sense. Now, the important thing about this is, guess what happened to me on March 22nd, 1966 in Greenville, North Carolina at East Carolina University? I went to a place called the Raskeller in a basement area of that little town, and I bought me two tall Pabst Blue Ribbons. And guess what happened? That thinking stopped. It stopped. I was fine, really. I mean, I could tell jokes that night. I walked over to people I didn't know, and I could share with them the wisdom of the world I had. I didn't know there were so many people in that place that needed to talk to me that night. I just didn't know that. Not until the second Peps. I mean, when I got the second one down, there was a lot more. I mean, I finally had to leave. I said, hey, I've given you all I can give you tonight. I'll have to come back. I've got more wisdom, but not tonight. I could sing, I was dancing, my feet were moving. It was unbelievable. And you know what I did for the next 22 years of my life? I drank to get back to Greenville, North Carolina, to the Raskeller, to that feeling, to that wonderful moment of memory that was unbelievable after 19 years of this. Hundreds of forms of fear, hundreds of forms of self-delusion. I really think that's my disease. Hundreds of forms of self-seeking. When I was 13 years old, my mom used to buy, and my dad, we'd had pigs and chickens, and they'd buy 200 pounds of Purina pig feed from up there in Raleigh, and they would bring it back, and my mother would pick out these sacks, because they had cotton gingham cloth, she called it, and she would pick out these sacks, the patterns, you know, it had little strawberries on a white field with little green, you know, stuff, and it had little purple flowers with green stems and green leaves. It's not something a guy should have to wear for a shirt, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it looked good on my sister, but it didn't look good on Larry and I. But my mother thought this was excellent material to make us shirts from. Well, she had this pattern, and nothing really wrong with these shirts except she starched them. She thought that starch was next to godliness or something. But, you know, you'd have to put them in the corner, kind of stand them up over there, just kind of boom, you know. And you put them on, and you'd have a hard time. But the funny part about these shirts is the collars. They started here, and they came normally, and they came on out, and they came on out, and they came on out, and they came on out. They came on out to about 8 inches off the shoulder to a point. And these things were real starched. And they were starched until I got into a rainstorm. And then they looked like dog ears. They just kind of laid down on me, you know. You know, I'd get up in the morning, this little freckle-faced, skinny, red-headed boy with my pig feed sack shirt on, I'm running to the bus. I'm fine, how are you? How much finer could you be? You know what I'm saying? My mom said we were picking butter beans real early, picking butter beans all morning, and my mom and dad love butter beans. And so we were shelling those things. And mother said, go get your eggs, because I would sell my eggs that we didn't need to Mr. Saul's, and I'd make money for candy. So I picked up my half-pound Maxwell House coffee can, jumped on my 21-inch bike. I'd painted lawn chair green because it was the only color in the garage that day. I started to ride to the woods. And my mother yelled, David, don't you ride that bike. You'll fall and break those eggs. And I pretended I didn't hear her. And so I got to get my eggs, and I came back to the back porch with my 13 eggs, my pea sack shirt on, and I hit my brakes, and the bike started sliding. And before I knew it, I was laying on my right side with 13 raw eggs, broken all on my face and my shirt and mud and the whole deal. My mother went berserk. She jumped off the porch. She came over, and as I got up, she kicked me down, and I got up, she kicked me down. Don't know how long that happened because my Aunt Marie was there, and she yelled, Letha, you're going to kill that boy, and my mother stopped. And as I lay there, I thought it was over. I started to get up that time, and she took the broom we'd been sweeping the hulls with, and she broke it across my back. And I lay there that time on the ground, and here's what happened to me. I really believe at that moment, the next few moments, the next few days, the next few weeks, the next few months, the next 27 years of my life, from 13 until 40, you know what I decided? That the God I understood as a child was not going to help me. Just that simple. You know, and you know how I understood God? You know, the third step says, turn my will and life over to care of God as I understood Him. I love that past tense. You know how I understood God when I was a kid? I used to lay on my back, 6, 7, 8 years old, flying kites in Raleigh, and I would see these beautiful clouds in the afternoon, Saturday, Sunday. And you know what I looked? I looked for shapes, like here's a dog head and here's a rabbit. And I knew if I looked long and hard enough, God was going to stick His head out and go, hi, Dave, how you doing? And I was going to go, oh, hi, God, I'm fine, how are you doing? You know, it was one of those deals. You know, I understood God. He never did, by the way. But, you know, I understood God as a friend. I understood God as someone who's there. I understood God that was a buddy. And that day, He wasn't. I was very frightened. And I didn't know what to do. You see, I missed the stadium meeting. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to live. I didn't have a plan. But you know what I knew I had to? Is create one. And for the next 27 years, if you ever ask me, David, what are you planning to do? Man, I could whip a plan on you in about 2 seconds. Didn't know how I was going to do it. Didn't have the capacity to do it or the resources, but I was going to do it. And then I'd get frightened because I knew I couldn't. That's how I lived. And you know, when I picked up that beer, when I picked up that wine, when I picked up that burden, you know what happened? I came within 10 minutes and 2 beers of having my life figured out many times. You know what I'm saying? Sitting at the bar, give me one more. And I've got a napkin, a little wet on the corner, but it's okay. And I'm writing my life's plan. You know, I've got a sad letter. I've got a song I'm going to sing. I'm going to make a million on this one. I got a poem. You know, give me one more beer. I've almost got it. I don't know if you know what I mean. I almost had it, folks. It was that close, my life, the answers, where I needed to go, what I was going to do. It was there. And then I'd wake up with a hangover. And nothing had happened. And I try to read this, you know, stuff in my pocket. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, that's how I live my life every day. It was going to be better. It was going to get, I could figure it out. Hundreds of forms of self-seeking. When I was 19, I started drinking. At 21, I was getting married. And I want to tell this because it's part of my story. And I think it's an important part to me. Is that I pulled a muscle in the shoulder, foot moving a washer and dryer, and they put me in the hospital and gave me Valium and Darvon and told me to take it every 4 hours. I did that for the next 20 years of my life. Really did. Faithfully honored those prescriptions. Why I say that is this, is that alcohol was my drug of choice in this sense, People have said, well, you know, you took this pill. What do you mean you're an alcoholic? I said, because alcohol was the only thing that got me where I needed to go. I don't know if you know what I'm saying. It's the only thing that got me there. I mean, you know, any of the over-counter stuff and any of the medicines I took, all that stuff, didn't matter if I could just get me. And that, between that third and fourth beer was something magical, something wonderful. You know, after about that fourth or that fifth, what a magical feeling it was. That's what got me there. I am an alcoholic. I continue to drink, and I don't want to give you a drunk log, but I do want to give you the last 2 years I drank. The last 2 years I drank, I live on a lake, and I have a little 14-foot Ajon boat, and every Saturday, like a beautiful day like today, I would think about and plan very detailedly, starting about 9 in the morning as I got drunk, I would think about how I was going to drown myself the next Saturday. You see, I was a closet drinker. I mean, I would go and look good. I showed up for work, and I had rules. If I drank before 5 o'clock, I was an alcoholic, so I couldn't drink before 5 o'clock until the last 2 years. Then I figured, what's the problem? You know, vodka and Diet Pepsi, it'll work, 4:30, just as good as it will 5. And 4. Didn't taste good, but it worked. Got me where I wanted to go. And it looked good, because, see, I had to look good. It looked like Diet Pepsi on my desk. I mean, what's the problem? I'm drinking Diet Pepsi. As if they couldn't smell it. And then it was 2. And it was 2:30. And then it was 1. It just kept moving up. And what I would do is I would come into my house, and the only place I felt safe in my world was a 5-foot by 7-foot bathroom. Let me tell you about my bathroom. Still got it. It's got ceramic tile, it's got a toilet, it's got a tub, it's got a magazine rack, it's got a louver door, and it's got an exhaust fan. And I was a closet smoker the last 5 years I smoked. I'd promise my children I'd quit, you know, and they'd beg me on their knees, oh yeah, I'm going to quit, son. And I'd go in there and hide my cigarettes up under the magazine rack. And what I'd do is I knew people didn't know I was drinking. I mean, I knew that because I would hide my beer under the celery, carrots, and lettuce in the bottom drawer of the refrigerator, and I knew they didn't look in there. I'm serious. And I would put 2 beers in my sport coat pockets like this, and I'd walk humpback back to the back of the house to my bathroom because I didn't want them to see me with the beer sticking out. And I'd sit down, I'd take my coat off, and I'd put my beers on my magazine rack, and I'd turn on the exhaust fan. I'd take me a cigarette out, light me a cigarette, pull out a magazine, pop me a top, drink me a beer. How much better could you want it? You know what I'm saying? How much better could you want it? I'd drink that beer and I'd roll it up in toilet tissue. I don't know why. If anybody has that experience, if you could share with me afterwards, I'd love to know if you know why you did that. I would drink another one. And I'd smoke another cigarette, read me another magazine, and I just had a ball in there. And Donna would come to the door. David, there's somebody on the floor. I can't come to find him in the bathroom. It was a wonderful place to be. Nobody could get to you. And then I'd roll the other one in toilet paper, put them back in my pocket, walk humpback back to the kitchen, and take these things out and put them halfway down in the trash. I have no idea why I did that. But I kept doing that. And finally, my family started to leave. They would leave or they'd go to bed. And you know what I'd do? I'd wake up in my easy chair, the chair that was so special the day we bought it. It was a wonderful chair. And I'd wake up having urinated on myself and on that chair. And I didn't know what happened. You see, when I was on the ground at 13, I knew I had to be successful. I just didn't know how to do it. But in my plans was not urinating on my best chair. That was not a part of my plan. It wasn't a part of my plan to wake up with strange people in strange places and not know where I was or how I got there or where my clothes were. Did not plan on that. But that's what happened. I violated every value, every principle that I ever, ever held dear in my life. That's what I did. I violated every family value as a father and as a husband that I ever held dear. I violated it. And you know what happened those last 2 years? The only answer that made sense was to drown myself in that lake. I had a plan. And it wasn't a bad plan. It was a peaceful plan. I was just going to do it next Saturday. Just next Saturday. I'm so grateful I never got there. And my family did an intervention. And my son, Scott, at 13, was willing to be honest with me, and for the first moment in my life that I saw the absolute terror he had of me, because I was drunk, and I was asking him to ride with me to a restaurant 17 miles away, and he said, Dad, I can't go. Mama made me promise I wouldn't ride with you. He was shaking, and I saw for a moment, in my stupor, I saw this young kid who I loved very much, scared of me. I didn't plan on that when I was 13. That wasn't my plan. So I went to treatment, and I got there, and the third day, Clara said to me, she said, why are you so angry? I said, I'm not angry. I'm fine. How are you, Clara? I'm fine. And she said, yes, you are angry. And I had my last Stark shirt on. I had, you know, I looked good. I blew dry my hair. I was cool. And I said, you know, I'm fine. And she said, no, you're not. You're lying to us. You're lying to the group. You know how you do that. And they jumped on me. They got nosy. And they said I was lying to them. So I said, okay, I'm angry with my mother. And she said, why? And I told her all the things, 13, 14, 15. I gave the whole litany. And I gave different people pieces of that litany. I never told anybody until I got into treatment the whole litany at one time. But I said, here's why. And she said to me, she said, where's your mother right now? I said, she's in Garner, North Carolina. She said, how far is that from here? I said, I don't know, 800 miles. I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And she said, well, what do you think your mother had for dinner last night? I said, I don't know. I was here in detox, Claire. She said, well, what do you think she had? I said, okay, potato salad, green beans, fried chicken, a roll, and lemon meringue pie and iced tea. She said, okay. She said, David, what did you have here in detox last night? I said, well, Claire, I wasn't too hungry. I had a little nauseated. I'm here in detox. You know, I've been here 3 days. I'm just trying to get my life straight now. And I said, I wasn't too hungry. A little roll, a little tea. She said, okay. She said, David, how much sleep do you think your mother got? I said, I don't know. She said, guess. I said, 7 hours. She said, David, how much sleep did you get last night here in detox? I said, about an hour and a half. I wasn't too sleepy, and I was thinking about a few things. Had to go to the day room to smoke, and I had to get out of bedroom. And she said, what do you think your mother had for breakfast this morning? I said, I don't know, Claire. She said, okay, guess. I said, 2 eggs, obese, grits, sausage, duh. She said, okay. She said, what did you have, David? I said, I wasn't too hungry, Claire. I was a little nauseated. You know, I wasn't feeling well. She said, David, where do you think your mother is right now? She said, how old is she? I said, she's 69. She said, well, where do you think she is? I said, well, she's retired. She's probably watching a soap opera, watching a game show, talking to a friend, something like that, in the morning time. And she said, David, where are you right now? Yeah, I felt the same way. And you know what? For the first time in my 41 years, I stopped. I don't know if you know what I mean by stopped. I hadn't stopped in a long time. I was just going to show people. I had to show them something. I don't know what I was going to show them. I guess that I was okay. But I stopped, and I said to Claire, I'm sitting in a treatment center trying to kill myself. And she said, David, it seems to me that your mother's life is going along pretty well right now. And that really hacked me off. And she said, it seems to me that you're destroying your life. And she said, the important thing for you to know is that your mother doesn't know you're fighting her. I said, of course she knows. I mean, if you're fighting somebody and they don't know you're fighting them, how can there be a fight? And she said, have you ever grabbed her by her blouse and pulled her face to your face and said, Mother, every day the rest of my life I'm going to show you and let her go? I said, no, I've never done that. She said, what have you said to your mother? I say, hi, Mom, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. I'm fine. How are you? You see, you know what I think I was going to show my mother? I was going to show my mother that I did not need her. That's what I was going to show her. And it took every ounce of energy to show her that. And I failed miserably in so trying. But that's what I was going to show her. She said she doesn't know. And she said, you've got a choice to stop fighting her. I said, I don't have a choice. She said, yes, you do. You can choose to admit you're powerless over alcohol. Step one, that your life is very unmanageable. You can choose to admit that you're powerless over your mother. That what happened in your life with her is you're powerless over. You can't change that. You can't change what happened when you were 13. But you've got to admit that you're powerless. You can choose. And she said, and then you must act on that choice by praying for her what you want for yourself. And I didn't like that either. I thought about doing a lot of things, my mom, but praying was not one of them. I said, what do I pray? She said, you pray for her, what do you want? I said, what do I want? I want to be happy, sober, and free. She said, then pray that. I said, but my mother doesn't drink. She said, that's okay. Pray for her to be sober anyway. And I had to agree to stay there, to stay, she said, I had to agree to pray, because if I didn't make that choice, if I didn't admit I was powerless, then I could not stay there because no human person could help me. It was an interesting concept. And I agreed I would pray, and I did. Nothing major happened. The shower curtain didn't fall or anything like that. But I did get back to group, and my counselor said, did you pray for her? I said, yes. And she said, then pray every day the next 2 weeks. We pray every day. For 2 weeks. I was there for 3 months, 2 weeks at a time. And every 2 weeks, would you pray again? The day I left, she said, would you please pray for your mother? You see, coming to believe for me that a power greater than me would restore me to sanity was very difficult, because that power greater than me didn't help me on that ground that day when I was 13. Didn't help me at all. So I didn't have a lot of faith in that power greater than me was going to help me. And she said, if you keep praying for your mother, you'll start believing that. She told me also, she said, I want you to go home and enjoy your family. Don't fix them. And I want to tell you, I said, sure, I'll be glad to do that. And all the way home, it hit me. I didn't know how to do that. Do you know how we lived in our house? I had a 17-year-old and a 13-year-old, two sons, when I went to treatment. 17-year-old, when I left, he threatened suicide. He was very angry. He punched his girlfriend's windshield from her inside of her car out on the hood with his fist. He punched holes in our walls of our home. He was very, very, very angry 17-year-old. Happened to be a big guy, too, 6'5", 225. And a big guy, tackle on the football team. And Donna would call me in treatment, and our sons were absolutely berserk because all of a sudden our paper house, our cardboard house started to fall. You know what the rules were? Ye who yelled the loudest and the longest won. That's it. You want to come on? Stay in here. Stay in, and we'll get this thing sorted out one day. But we're going to stay till we just yell and yell and yell. Now, Scott, he was our 13-year-old. He would get on his bike and leave. He's the kind of guy you go on vacation, don't realize they're gone for about 10 minutes. You know, they're not even in the car because he was never there. I don't know where he slept or ate, but he did. He made it through, but he would come back. If we were still arguing, he would go. David was there. And so she said, go in and enjoy your family. Don't fix them. And what I did is I bought a joke book by Milton Berle, 10,000 Jokes. A little alcoholic. Because you know what happened? In our house, you know how we laughed? We laughed from here up. It was called he-he-he. He-he-he. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't a belly laugh at all. It was waiting for something else to fall. When's Dad going to come home drunk? And when's he going to cuss out Mom? And when's Mom going to throw something at Dad? And on and on and on and on and on. And so we just never got real comfortable with our laughing. And so I thought, I'll tell them some jokes. So I would memorize jokes on the way home from work. And I'd go in and say, David, Scott, I got a couple of jokes for you, son. Dun, 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 dun. And I'd tell them these jokes. And they would look at me in utter amazement. They weren't laughing. I realized I didn't do it too good. So I'll go back and I'll practice. I'd go in the bedroom and practice these jokes. And I'd come back out. And I'd say, well, what about this one? Dun, 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 dun. Boom. And they finally started laughing, not at my jokes, but the fact that I couldn't tell a joke. That was the point. And you know what happened? We started to belly laugh. We really did. We started to belly laugh. I tell you what happened. I was home 4 days. Tell you how serious it was. I was home 4 days. I was going back to work for the first time in 3 months. Frightening time coming back out of treatment. And my son, David, was running the TV wide open on Monday morning, about 4:30 in the morning. It woke me up. I couldn't sleep anyway. I woke up and I went in and I said, in my best treatment motif, I walked in and said, David, I need to share with you my feelings about how this TV... You know, I learned that 90 days in treatment. I learned all that stuff, you know. I need to tell you about my feelings about this loud TV. I'm very frightened because I have to go to work in the morning. I need for you to cut the TV down. And he looked at me off his sofa and he said, I'm not going to cut it down and you can't make me. And I said, no, son, let me explain to you my feelings here. And I went right back in my treatment motif and what I'd learned, you know, in the group. And he jumped off the sofa and he came over and he started to punching me in the chest. And he said, I'm not going to cut it down and you can't make me. And I lost my treatment motif at this point. And you know, I started yelling at him, and I was punching him in the chest. And I was looking up at him. He's 6'5". I was like, you know, and I was claiming my property back. See, I knew what had happened. I've been gone for 3 months, and guess who took over the house? Yeah, this boy. He took over control of this house. And so I started claiming property. This is my house. This is my TV. I paid for this TV. This is my sofa you're laying on. I mean, I did all that stuff. You know, and I claimed it all back. You know, I was going to let him know who owned that house. And he yelled at me as loud as I've ever heard any words. He was that far from my nose. He said, you alcoholic, you destroyed my life. Get out of it. I'd called myself an alcoholic for 93 days in meetings. Somehow this was different. And everything within me wanted to hit him. And I don't know why I didn't. No clue. No clue. And I walked off, and I went down the hall, and you know what I was thinking? This program and all that stuff, that bull they told me for 93 days is not worth anything. I'm sober. I've been in treatment. Look what I've given up. And look how my son's treating me. Look at how my son's treating me. I walked in the bedroom, and I said, Donna, did you hear that? Well, you could hear it from three houses away. It was not a question, did you hear it or not? I said, what do you think I should do? And you know what she said? She said, why don't you call your sponsor? Fried my nose, I want to tell you. So I called Keith. I said, and I was angry by this time. I was really angry. I was loaded for bear. I said, Keith, you know what my son just did to me? And I said, he just called me an alcoholic. And he said, Keith, real quietly, I woke him up. It's like 4:30 in the morning. He said, well, aren't you? I said, well, yeah. He said, well, then he called you what you are. I said, oh, okay. That one didn't take. I said, but did you know what else happened? He was punching me in the chest and yelling at me. He said, well, let me ask you a question, David. I said, sure. He said, were you punching him in the chest and yelling at him? I said, yeah, but he provoked me. That's not a good word to use, my sponsor. Provoked is not a good word. Here's what he did. He said, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to go back in there and say to your son, David, I'm very sorry I yelled at you, and I'll try not to do that again. And son, may I have permission to hug you? Thank you, Keith. Thank you. Hey, I'm so sorry I woke you up. I really am. Hey, I appreciate this. Thank you so much. Just thank you. Okay, yeah, I'll let you know how it goes. Sure. And you know what I knew? You know how I knew how to handle that stuff? Do you know how I handled situations like that all their lives? I wouldn't look at them for 2 weeks. I'd walk down the hall and they would walk right by me and I never would greet their eyes. I would never... They would say at the dinner table, pass me the potatoes, and I would pass the potatoes, and just as they got to David's hand, I'd sit them down and look away. I'd show him who's in charge. That's how I handle stuff like that. You know what I mean? That's how you handle it. So I got in the shower, went to work. 5 o'clock, but I went to work. And when I got there, this ball of whatever pain exploded in my stomach and my gut like I'd never experienced, and I knew that I was going to have to do one of two things. I was going to have to pick up that bottle of vodka I used to steal from the chairman of the board's liquor closet, which was about 20 feet from my office, and drink it, or I was going to have to go home and do what my sponsor said. And I didn't want to do either one. But I decided to go home. And when I got home, it was just at daybreak, and my son David was just prancing in the backyard. He was one angry human being. And I walked over to him, and I said, David, I'm very sorry I yelled at you, and I'll try not to do that again. And he went, huh? He looked at me like I was a stranger, and in fact, I was. And I said, son, may I have permission to hug you? He said, what? I said, can I hug you? He said, yeah. He was like hugging this podium. He was standing there like this. It was just... I walked over to him, and I didn't touch him. You know, I didn't want to touch him, but I had my hands like this, and I closed my eyes almost on his shoulder, and I thought, my sponsor is full of bull. I did the two lines he gave me. I don't know if your sponsor ever gave you lines, but I said the two lines he gave me, and I knew I was going to have to put my tail between my legs and go back to that office, and my son would control the house forever now. And just as I started to let David go, you know what happened? My son grabbed me, and he hugged me, and he wept on my shoulder, and he said, please forgive me, Dad. Please forgive me. I am so sorry I called you and yelled at you today and called you an alcoholic. I am so proud of you that you're trying a new way of life, and I want to support you, Dad. Please don't stop going to those meetings. And you know what I could do? I could hug him. I could hug him, and I could tell him how sorry I was that for 17 and a half years he had lived in my home, and not one moment until the last 94 days had he known me without alcohol or drugs in my body. I was very sorry that I did not plan that when I was on the ground at 13. Just didn't plan it. And you know what we did? We stood in my backyard and we just cried and hugged. And you know two important things that happened that morning out in the backyard? Number one, we started over. I don't know if you know what I'm saying. David and I started over. It took Scott and I 8 years to start over. It took 8 years. Don and I, it took us several years, and some days we don't start over now. And we're still working on that. We want to keep going back after a long 30-year marriage. But the point I'm making is this. We started over, and it's been different between he and I since that day. The other thing is I came to believe a little more that a power greater than me was going to restore me to sanity and my son to sanity and our relationship to sanity, you see. So he asked me, he said,
did you talk to Keith this morning? I said, yeah, I did. He said, well, I want to talk to Keith and thank him. I told him what Keith had suggested I do this. So we went in and called Keith. We both got on the phone and woke up Keith again. Good morning, Keith. You awake? No, okay. David wants to talk to you. So David talked to him, and we were so excited. I said, thank you, Keith. It's wonderful. We've started. It looks like it's a real breakthrough. Thank you. And he said, well, David Jr. said, I got to go to school. I'll talk to you later. And he hung up, and I said, well, Keith, I hope you have a good day. I'm going to go back to work now. He said, no. He said, we're going to talk some more right now. I said, what do you mean? He said, I want you to do this for me, David. He said, from this moment on, you cannot parent your children anymore. You must sponsor them. I said, what does that mean? He said, that means you do not give them any advice. You only give them your experience, if you have any, when they ask you for it. I said, but they'll never ask me. They don't want to know what I got to say. He said, well, isn't that wonderful? That part of your life's over. You know, for a second or two, it felt pretty good. He said, I'm talking, it is none of your business what they do. They will come and ask you. You've got to let these kids go. You're killing them, and you're killing yourself. I still struggle with sponsoring my children as late as this afternoon when I called my youngest son at 5:30. I still want to try to get... See, I had a wonderful 12-step plan for each of my family. I had worked it out beautifully. But what I'm learning is each of them in their own time and in their own way have to do what they have to do. I want to go back and pick up this thing with the story with my mom because I don't want to leave it where I left it. I went forward with steps 4 and 5. And making a decision in step 3 to begin the process of turning my will and life over. I had to do an inventory to prove that I made the decision. And so I did that. And my sponsor said, I want you to put fears and then pray this prayer. I had all these kind of notebooks, and I was going to kind of copyright this whole thing I was writing. And he said, no, I want you to take this yellow legal pad and this number 2 pencil. He said, you can't lie with a pencil. He told me that. And he said, but I want you to write fears. And he put at the top a prayer. Dear God, show me today, in your time, in your way, what I'm afraid of, what my fears are. And I was supposed to sit down at night and pray that prayer and get quiet for 15 minutes and write any word down. I was prohibited from writing a sentence or a paragraph. It had to be a word or a phrase because he knew I was going to try to write a book. He skipped a couple pages and he put resentments. He put whom, what happened, and what did it affect, okay, in the big book, page 65. And so I did that. My mom, she kicked me. I was frightened, physical security, things like that. And then we went through that part. And then he put sex, and he left the rest of the book. He said, I want you to pray the prayer. God, please show me in your time who I'm resentful at, and also what sexual activity kept me from knowing you or separated me from you. And so we did that, and I went through that process. And when I started with him on the fifth step, he said to me, turn to page 67 in the book, big book, and he said, I want you to tell me what your part and the resentment was. Because it says, was I frightened, dishonest, selfish on page 67? What was my part in the resentment? And you know what? I was pretty offended by that. But you know why? Because the act, what my mother did to me, justified the resentment. You know what I'm saying? I mean, look what she did to me. I mean, my gosh, wouldn't you feel that way? And you know what? I started to using all my life the resentment to make myself a victim. Do you know what a victim is? The victim for me was that it excused unexcusable behavior. It justified unjustifiable actions I took. I'd sit at bars and they'd say, David, I think you've had a little bit too much tonight. Why don't you head on home? I'd say things like, if you were raised by my mother and beat like she beat me, you were beat like she beat me, you'd drink too. Yeah, I guess you have another. Have another. I'm sorry, David. I'm sorry it was so tough for you. I was a victim. You see, here's what happened. When I'm a victim, Here's how this started. About second year or third year of sobriety, I came home one night and my boss had said to me at 5:00, I can't believe you did that project that way and you really messed it up. And it was one of those good 5:00 Friday afternoon conversations. You know, you kind of take it with you for the weekend. The gift that keeps giving type thing. And I got home at 9:30 on Friday night and my mind is like this. You know, he's going to fire me Monday morning. I know he is and I'm gone. I mean, I'm out of there. And I've got another job. I got to find another. Got to do a resume. I was into this thing pretty good. And I called Keith. And I said, Keith, you know what my boss said to me today? And he said, what? And I told him. He said, okay. He said, David, what time is it? I said, it's 9:30. He said, is that a.m. or p.m.? I said, Keith, it's dark outside. It's p.m. He said, okay. He said, where are you standing? I said, I'm standing in my house. He said, look down and make sure. He said, what color is the carpet? I said, brown. He said, you're in the den. I said, right. He said, David, when did your weekend start? The only weekend that you're going to have this week to celebrate the work that you did this week, when did it start? I said, 5 o'clock. He said, what time is it? I said, 9:30. He said, you know what? I bet if you try hard, you can really louse up your whole Friday night. And you won't have it. You can choose to let this go by 9 o'clock tomorrow, and you just louse up your whole Friday. He said, you can choose to do that. He said, if you work real hard, you can choose to let all this go by 6 o'clock Saturday afternoon and mess up your whole Saturday day. He said, you'll have to work a little harder to get that one to occur. He said, but again, you know, you could wait till 10 o'clock on Sunday and just mess up your whole Saturday night. He said, of course, you could go for the whole roll of the dice and wait until 9 o'clock Monday morning and just screw up your whole weekend. He said, the choice is yours. I said, I don't have a choice. He said, yes, you do. And then he said these words, David, what do you get out of being a victim? And I said, I don't get anything, Keith. And you know what he said? You must get something because you keep doing it to yourself. And he slammed the phone down. Well, I called him back. I said, let's talk about this. And you know what? For the next 3 years, we talked about that. And I started looking at my behavior. And you know what? As a victim, I do. I can work the 12-step program wonderfully in my persecutors' lives. But I have a hard time working it in mine because I can't get honest. He said, I want you to take your 8-step list, the top 15 people that you'll amends to, and I want you to tell me how many of those were your primary persecutors. I said, okay, I'll do that. So I started, and I looked at the list, and the 13 of the 15 were my persecutors all my life. Now, let me tell you who they were. It was God. He let my grandmother die of cancer. He let my dad die of cancer. He let my first girlfriend leave me. I mean, I knew exactly what God had done. He didn't help me on the ground that day. I knew exactly what he'd done to me. It was my mother, my father, my brother, my sister-in-law, my sister, my brother-in-law. It was my father-in-law, my mother-in-law. It was my wife, my two children. It was my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law. It was Aunt Lossie and a girl named Betty Jo at work. Those were my persecutors. And you know what? I give up by being a victim. I give up the right to change. I have to stay the same. I give up the right to not live in crisis. I have to live in crisis. I have to tell you things are not so good. Because if they are good, then I'm no longer a victim. And I give up the right to an intimate relationship with my persecutor. And so I came to you in 1988 abjectly alone. The only people I believe that really, really, really understood me were the person sitting to my left and to my right in the bar. They understood me. And the bartender. He was good. But none of my family. Not a one of them. I treated them without intimacy. Absent intimacy is what I did. When we got to 6 and 7, he said, I want you to start looking at your defects. I did. He said, I want you to start looking at why you use the 7 deadly sins. He said, I want you to see why you can't start accepting yourself. Because 1 to 5 was to discover who I am. 6 through 10 is to accept who I am. And I don't like that because there's a lot of those things I didn't like about me. And he said, I want you to start accepting the fact that God has accepted you. And when you can accept that, and what I'm finding today is when I can accept the fact that God's accepted me in my worst moments, in my drunkenness, then I don't need those defects as much. I don't have to survive. I got to step 8, and he said, I want you to start acting differently so people can treat you differently. I said, what does that mean? He said, I want you to stop acting like a child, and people will start treating you like an adult. I didn't like that either. He said, I want you to start writing your mother. I hadn't seen her in 2 years, been praying for her every day. But I wouldn't go see her. I'd saw her half day Christmas, half day Thanksgiving, didn't want to see her. I would want to see Mom. I'd get up there. At 10, 12 minutes into the visit, I would wonder, why in the world did I come here? I do not want to be around her anymore. It's like she had a vacuum cleaner sucking my insides out or something. It was terrible. And so I didn't want to see him. She said, I want you to write. He said, I want you to write your mother. And I said, what do I say? He said, dear Mom, thinking of you, David. I said, but I'm thinking bad thoughts. He said, but she won't know that. She doesn't know you're fighting her. I said, oh, okay. So I wrote her a letter. 3 weeks later, he said, write her another one. So I wrote, dear Mom, thinking of you, David. And then I got a letter back. Funny how things work that way. And she said, David, thank you for thinking of me every day. I didn't say that, but she thought that. It was positive, too. He was right. She didn't know I was fighting her. And so she sent me this little cartoon out of the paper. Well, I wrote her back. Well, she wrote me back. Well, I wrote her back. We only live 65 miles apart. And I wrote her back. It's interesting how that works. And so then I called her and I said, why don't you come and visit Larry and I? So she came to Fayetteville, 71 years old, and she sat down on the end of the sofa and she said these words. She didn't say hello. She didn't say, I'm glad to be here. She said, David, when I was 6 years old, I sat in my great-grandma Honeycutt's lap and she ran her fingers through my hair and told me what beautiful red hair I had and what a nice, wonderful girl I was. And everything within me wanted to say, Mom, I've heard that dumb story 250 times. Let's talk. You're not here today. I don't want to hear the story. And something stopped me. And you know what I saw? I saw that my mother was absolutely frightened to death. She did not know what to say to her own two children. I saw me in her. I saw my hundreds of forms of fear and self-delusion and self-seeking and self-pity. I saw them that day. I didn't know that about my mom. I didn't know she was frightened. I thought she was mean. I just thought she was mean. I kept writing her, calling her, and on my fourth sobriety birthday, I said, let's go on a trip. We never, the two of us, had ever been anywhere together without the other family. We rode to Washington, D.C. to see the cherry blossoms out of North Carolina. And on the way up, she said, David, I want to tell you about my childhood. She'd been very close-mouthed about her childhood. I said, sure. She said, your grandfather, when I was 10 years old, I burned some biscuits in a wood-burning stove, and he took a tobacco stick and beat me. And she said, I was terrorized, sonny. She said, do you know how it feels to live in terror that you're not enough? I said, Mom, I sure do. She said, well, I just wanted to let you know that because that's how I grew up. And she said, maybe that's why I was so hard on you boys. I said, Mom, remember the time when I was 13 and I broke those eggs and I fell with a bike? And what I was going to tell her is, I'm sorry that I didn't mind you. She yelled at me to not ride that bike. I heard that, but I decided I was going to do it anyway. And that's what I was going to tell her. And you know what she said? Just as I started, I said, remember when we were 13, I broke those eggs? She said, no. She said, don't talk about that. She said, let me tell you that there has not been a day in the last 37 years that I have not thought about that incident with tremendous shame and tremendous guilt. Can you ever forgive me, David? And you know what I realized? My mom had paid a greater price than I had paid. And it was time to let that go. It was time to stop being a victim about that. It was time. It was just time. I don't know about you. See, as a victim, you know what I do? In fact, it says it on page 66 of the big book, is I rob myself from the sunlight of the Spirit. I squander the very hours of life that are worthwhile. And Keith said to me one day, when are you going to get tired of doing that? When are you going to decide to live not as a victim, but to celebrate your recovery? When are you going to do that? And I really think for me, that's an important step that only working the steps can give me. Step 10 is making daily looking at the inventory. Was I selfish, dishonest, or afraid today? Very important step for me because that's where I look at my resentments. How have I looked at them, and do I need to pray for that person again? Step 11 is really about getting quiet, meditating. I tell you, I was 3 years sober, and I couldn't meditate. I tried with the page 99 and the 12 and 12, you know, make me a channel of thy peace, St. Francis prayer. And I'd say, well, what's peace? What's a channel? I'd start thinking about it. You know, we're channel. Here's peace. Here goes a channel. You know. I couldn't. After 10 minutes, I was exhausted. And I was reading the ODAT book one day that my wife had. And on November 10th, it said, if you will get quiet and look at and stare at one object like a piece of fruit or a piece of a flower and just let no thoughts in for 60 seconds, if you will do that, that's meditation. Well, I tried that. And you know what happened? I was looking at a white rosebud, and over the years it's grown and it's blossomed. But you know what? For the first time in my life, a ball or a knot right here left me, and only when it left me did I know it was there. Please hear that part. Only when it left me did I understand the tension and anxiety I had lived with all of my life, and the only time I didn't feel it was when I was drinking. And it went away for the night. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I want to tell you about Bob. Bob's a good friend of mine, and my dad died before I got sober, and I went out, and Keith said I needed to write a letter, and I did, and I read it to God, read it to myself on my knees, and read it to my sponsor, and then went out to the grave and read it to my dad. He said, I want you to pray that God send to you someone that you can care for like a father. And so I did that, and I have two, Sam and Bob. And Bob's from Wilmington, and Bob, he's about 72, and he's a great fellow, talks real slow. And he'll call me and say, David, this is Bob. I say, oh, Bob, how you doing? I'm doing fine, son. How you doing? And we'll talk for a while. He's in AA, and he invites me down to speak, and we're going to have shrimp together. And he'll say, as we close, he says, "Well, son, I got to go now." And he said, "I just want to let you know I love you, and there's not a thing you can do about it." Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? You see, it's like this for me. My recovery has been like South American Indians capture monkeys. They capture them in a very unusual way. They do this. They make this big clay pot, solid clay. They put this little noose neck at the top in a cavity. And in this noose neck, it's just big enough for the monkey to get his hand and arm in. And then they drop sweet beans down in this cavity. And they put these large pots out in the opening in the jungle in the morning. Well, the monkey smells the beans, sees the, and is curious, comes over, puts his hand down in and grabs a couple of those beans. And then he can't get his fist out. He's captured. And he will stay there all day long, holding all of those beans. Now, all he's got to do to be free is let go. He can slide his hand out. But he'll hang on all day long, and then the native Indians will come, and they'll knock him over the head and knock him unconscious. And when they knock him unconscious, they let go of the beans. They just slide their hand out, use the same jug, the same beans to catch the next monkey the next day. And they put the monkey in a cage, take him out of the river, and sell him for experimentation. Now, you know what? I am like that monkey. Everything that has happened in my life or didn't happen or was said or wasn't said or done or not done, I have held on to it and held on to it. I don't know why. I don't know why I was trying to prove something, but it was very, very painful. And you know what the 12 steps are about for me? I thought I was supposed to have a spiritual awakening like, boom, it's going to happen. But what I'm realizing is that I'm working the 12 steps on each of those little beans I'm holding on to. There was a time when my mother, the relationship with her was so painful that I had to admit I was powerless, that my life had become unmanageable. I had to come to believe that a power greater than me would restore my mother and myself to sanity and make a decision regarding that one thing, the relationship with my mother, that I would start the process of turning that relationship over, that I would inventory that in it, admit that to God and to my sponsor and to myself. What is my part in this? What is my part in the resentment? And then I would go forward and look at my defects. And am I willing to let those go? Am I willing to accept the acceptance? Would I then make amends to her? And would I look at it daily in step 10? And would I, in inventory, and would I pray and meditate about her in that relationship? And having had a spiritual awakening about that relationship, would I then go back and say, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. I come to believe there's a power greater than me that will help restore me to sanity regarding this alcohol. I'm going to make a decision to turn my will and my life over regarding alcohol to a power greater than me. And I'm going to start with inventorying. What is my fear? What are my resentments and my sexual activity as a result of my drinking? And I'm going to go through those steps again. And I'm going to do it with my relationship with my wife. I'm going to do it with my son. I'm going to keep doing it. I only will do it, I found, when I hurt bad enough. Then I'll start doing it again. Keith said, David, you've got to understand there's a difference between the act and the resentment. I didn't understand that. The act justified the resentment. He said, if a child is sexually or physically abused, then that child is not at fault. They're a child. If you can take that act and leave it right there, then what you have to do is the moment that act is over, what is your part in the resentment for the remaining 27 years? And that's what I had to look at. I didn't want to look at that. Didn't want to own that. Because, see, it was all me. It was all me. If I look at it that way. What a privilege to be here. I want to thank you for allowing us to come. I want to thank you for giving us the privilege of being with you and sharing with you. And as Bob says to me, and I mean it, I love you, and there's not a thing you can do about it. Good night.